Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We are pleased to have back here on the program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, always on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, he is here with a show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We designed this program to be a kind of a general opportunity for people to ask healthcare questions. He sees people of all ages in his practice. He has children, he has grown-ups, people who come in with a variety of complaints and concerns that he responds to. So the idea is here, if you have questions, you can call in and talk with the doctor. I always caution people at the beginning here that there's a limit to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. So obviously we can't do diagnosis over the phone. However, it's a place you can ask some general questions and you can start here, and then you might need to see your own doctor or someone who can see you. But questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
We already have somebody here who would like to talk with you, so we'll do that. We'll go right to the phone, and this is someone in Danville on our line four. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 70-year-old lady, and I got varicose veins pretty bad, but had never any trouble with them, and I am wearing always support hose because I'm a beautician and I'm standing a lot. Now I developed on a small part phlebitis with a reddish patch and a knot. Doctor said it is superficial. And the doctor subscribed K-Tech antibiotics, 500 milligram two times a day for 10 days, and a salve to put on, which I probably, it's triamcin, I have to spell it probably.
It's triamcinolone.
Yeah.
It's a cortisone-based cream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For 10 days. And to put that on two to three times a day. So far, I see no improvements after 1 week of treatment. I put the leg up a lot when I can. Do you have any suggestion or what I can expect?
Basically, the real problem here is just gravity.
Yeah.
The varicose veins tend to swell any time that your feet are dependent, if you're sitting or standing for prolonged periods of time. The real treatment here is to elevate the leg, use some warm compresses over the inflamed area.
Warm, not hot, warm.
Warm.
Yeah.
And the key is to stay off of it. The superficial phlebitis, it needs to be distinguished from the deep thrombophlebitis. The superficial thrombophlebitis does not have any real risk of blood clots traveling anywhere in your system. A blood clot deep in the venous system can be a problem.
Yeah.
But this is really more of a superficial problem, but the real culprit here is gravity. And until you get off your leg, elevate it significantly, use the warm compresses, it's really going to take a long, long time to settle down by itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a little knot, maybe a quarter of an inch, you know, quarter of an inch, a little knot.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor maybe was hoping it could be opened or opened by itself.
Generally, they will open by themselves. This is simply an area of the vein that's very swollen, and it will go down over time.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very uncommon that they would need to actually be surgically opened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had one more question. I forgot now. The antibiotics, of course, they start now giving me stomach problems, you know.
The antibiotics are not going to be terribly helpful in this particular setting unless your physician felt that the skin around the vein had become infected. Now, it's very common for it to be reddish just due to inflammation, but that's just a chemical irritation and isn't actual infection.
Oh.
So you may want to double-check with your physician. If they truly thought there was infection present and it's not improving, then you may need some medication changed.
Yeah.
But if there's really no significant concerns about active infection, then the antibiotic really is unnecessary.
Evidently, this is why it isn't helping, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And then when I get done with them, that will be Thursday. This is the last day, 10 days. Should I maybe not have any more antibiotics? Of course, I'm going back to him Friday.
Right. It's probably not going to be necessary to extend your antibiotic use. No.
Yeah. Warm compresses and, well, of course, the port hose. And the salve is okay?
The salve is fine. It's simply a topical form of cortisone to try and reduce some of the inflammation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Is this something that almost every, if you live long enough, almost everyone is going to see some kind of varicose vein development? Or is that really not so common?
Actually, it's not necessarily uniformly present in everybody, but, you know, gravity takes its toll on all of us eventually. Mm-hmm. This is actually much more prominent in women. Typically because varicosities increase during pregnancy and childbearing, and it definitely increases with any type of prolonged sitting or standing, again, just due to gravity. And there's also very much a hereditary or familial tendency toward this problem as well. The usual treatment is, as our last caller mentioned, is some type of physical compression to keep the vein from stretching further, and that's basically support hose. You can oftentimes buy over-the-counter support hose, or if necessary, your physician can prescribe a custom manufactured support hose where they actually take measurements of your leg and incrementally increase the pressure in the stocking to provide the maximum amount of support. Mm. And then if that's still not sufficient, then there are several different procedures, including surgical removal, to actually get rid of the varicose veins themselves. You can inject them with chemicals that cause the vein to sclerose down so that they won't carry blood anymore, or you can actually just surgically remove the vein itself.
Okay. We have a caller here, another caller here, someone on cell phone, so we will go there next, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a quick question, and of course it's an allergy question this time of year. I generally take the generic loratadine. I usually just buy like a big bottle of like 150 tablets. The problem is at a certain point it's really not that effective, and so my question is it harmful to take a loratadine twice a day, like once in the morning, once in the evening, to try and curb that? I guess I just find that there's diminishing returns after taking it for a couple of months.
And that's not necessarily all that unusual. And occasionally, rather than exceeding the recommended total daily dose, oftentimes just switching antihistamines for a while will be helpful. Benadryl, chlortrimeton, some of the other available antihistamines used for a period of time may be helpful. Or additionally, depending on the symptoms, simply adding a decongestant to the antihistamine. So basically some Sudafed, if the pharmacist will sell it to you now.
Yeah, I do have some of that. My physician's assistant gave me a whopping dose of that stuff one time when I just could not drain properly. So what is there besides loratadine that's non-drowsy that's over-the-counter? Because the other stuff is like sleeping pills to me.
Right, and that is the major drawback to most of the over-the-counter antihistamines, is their sedative side effects. The other non-sedating antihistamines are still prescription, and they're basically Allegra and Zyrtec. And those are in the same general chemical class as the loratadine, but are still prescription only. The other thing that you can think about is the addition of one of the nasal steroid sprays.
Oh.
These are your Flonase, Nasacort, Rhinocort type medications. These are topical steroids that are sprayed into the nose and the sinuses, often work very, very well in conjunction with the oral antihistamines.
Okay. Is the Nasacrom over-the-counter now, or is that still prescription?
Nasacrom itself is an over-the-counter medication and is different than the nasal steroids that are prescribed.
Oh, okay.
And the the last thing that you can do, if you have a particular season where you're really, really bad, you can, and if you can anticipate it, in some instances, your physician, assuming you don't have any contraindication, can give you a cortisone injection.
Oh.
Just before the start, say oftentimes a ragweed season. I frequently have a number of my patients come in the first week or two of August. They get their cortisone injection, and it basically carries them 4 to 6 weeks.
Oh, that would be nice.
And that can be done either instead of or in addition to the other things that we've talked about.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to line number two. This is someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah.
This is a question on orthopedics and partial knee replacements. I had one in 2002, and now 4 years later, I'm afraid something is horribly loose inside. Now, without actually getting the chance to examine me, do you know of what some of the outcomes could be if, depending on what's loose inside?
Was there a new injury?
This was a chronic condition. I had 4 arthroscopies in my life, starting in my 20s. I'm 49 years old. 4 or 5 arthroscopies, which led up to a partial knee replacement on the medial side.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, I was advised to get into a different line of work other than construction, but out of economic necessity, I kept working.
Yeah.
Up until a week and a half ago. And then I finally was laid off with great joy and satisfaction because I had worked for a long time with this contractor, but I really enjoyed being with them. But within 72 hours, some of the components of this partial knee replacement on the inside of my knee, something is coming loose inside there. You want to lead me through?
Well, the components of joint replacements will, over time, indeed loosen. But this is way, way too soon for what would normally be expected.
Right.
You haven't had a re-injury to the operated knee?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. And I mean, I would think the biggest potential for trauma would be a lateral injury, where there would be lateral force applied.
And it would be something that you would notice, so
yeah.
This wouldn't be anything minor. Your next step is to get new x-rays.
That's been done.
Of your knee.
That's been done.
Okay. And they showed?
We'll find out on the 26th
when we get
an interpretation. But okay. In the meantime, I am wearing the custom knee brace that comes with every knee surgery like that.
Mm-hmm.
No ligament damage has happened, mind you. It's
okay.
All structural.
Right.
So, I got you on the phone. I just figured if you wanted to list for me, like you started going down that road when you said this is way too early for things to fall apart.
Right. In the absence of some new trauma, obviously, if you get hit by a bus, that's a different story. But in this particular case, if components are coming loose but there's no other problem, that may be something that can be fixed. But in many instances, a partial knee replacement is simply a way of buying time before you have to do a complete or total knee replacement. So this may represent simply a problem with the actual mechanics of your current replacement, or it may reflect a bigger problem necessitating a total knee replacement. But until you get your x-rays, you know, it's really hard to say.
At this rate, have there been instances where the pins holding the prosthetics going into the femur and the tibia, because of shaking, jarring, whatever, the guy insists on becoming, doing a marathon or two again, or
mm-hmm.
something idiotic with a partial, with a full knee replacement, or even a partial. In situations that you're aware of, were they able to go back in and simply replace the silica cement that holds those pins in place?
It is possible to repair something that is just loose, depending on the degree of wear and tear on the rest of the components, either some or all of it may need to be replaced.
What are these likelihoods that, I don't know, you hear anecdotally at your doctor's meetings and stuff like that, your conferences?
There isn't any way to predict in this particular instance, your instance, without the additional information that's contained on your X-ray.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm panning for any sort of anecdotal evidence or information you may have come across in your lifetime as a doctor.
It's really going to depend on what things look like. And until that information's available, everything else is just a guess.
It is pure speculation.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for speculating.
Good luck.
I'm going to need it.
Here this morning in this part of Focus 580, our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor. He is with us every other month, always on Monday, in the 11 o'clock hour. We talk about health care and give you a chance to ask questions. And again, as I said at the beginning, you know, there's so much we can do when the doctor can't see you, but I don't want to also discourage anybody from calling, obviously, because it's an opportunity to ask some general questions and get some background information. And I know he will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here. This is someone on our line number one in Champaign, I think. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a pacemaker, but my question is not about pacemakers. I have a wonderful doctor at Carl who manages such things for me. My question is, and I know I cannot have any kind of MRI anywhere on my body because I have a pacemaker. What other imaging possibilities are there for me? I'm happy to say I don't need them, but just as future store of information.
Basically, the non-magnetic forms of imaging that are available in current medical systems right now would include plain X-rays.
What are those? Oh, plain X-rays.
Just
right.
A plain X-ray, like you'd get a chest X-ray or an X-ray of your elbow if you heard it.
Right.
That's not a problem with your pacemaker. A CAT scan, which is a computerized X-ray, doesn't involve magnetism, so again, is not a problem with your pacemaker. Things where dye are put into the various systems can also be X-rayed, so any of the angiography, venography type studies can be done.
What is venography?
Just you're putting dye into a vein, as opposed to arteriography, where you're putting it into an artery.
Ah, okay. And CAT scans would be used in, I know there's some things MRIs are better for, and mm-hmm. some things CAT scans are better for.
Right.
Just a second, let me get rid of this. Okay.
Generally speaking, the bony structures or more solid structures of the body are better visualized with a CAT scan.
Uh-huh.
And some of the soft tissue structures, when you're looking at, say, muscles or tendons or nerves like the spinal cord, are better visualized with the MRI. There is some overlap between them in terms of what they can look at, but sometimes one will give you a little better look than the other, depending on exactly what it is you're trying to look for. And the other technique that can be used, depending on, again, what you're looking at, is ultrasound, which is, again, a sound wave-based form of viewing the inner workings of the body. And all of these would be quite safe with your pacemaker.
And what is a PET scan?
That is basically a study done with a radioactive isotope and would still be considered a study that could be done with your pacemaker.
Okay. And PET scans can be done on the brain or everywhere in the body?
They can actually be done in other parts of the body other than the brain. They're most commonly used right now for following cancer patients. because the metabolically active cancer cells show up very well in many instances on a PET scan where the radioactive isotope is being actively taken up by cells that are metabolically very active.
Okay, well, thank you very much for adding to my store of knowledge.
You're welcome.
Very good. Thank you for the call. Let's continue. We have somebody up in the Chicago area next. This is a caller in Des Plaines, line 4. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hi, doctor. Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
I wonder if you could, my question concerns what has been described by my doctor as the sed rate, and I had experienced great pain in my legs and other areas of my body in early August. I was told to stop the Lipitor I was taking, and within a couple of weeks had an 87 reading on the sed rate. Within about 3 weeks, it had dropped to 65, still off the Lipitor. And perhaps 10 days after that, a third reading of 44. However, the fourth taking of the blood, I saw this tremendous spike up to 107 on the sed rate. And I'm not sure what all of this is suggesting, and is there something terrible going on here? Should I be preparing myself for something really bad?
Not necessarily, but you do need to have a couple of questions answered. In general, a sedimentation rate, it's called an ESR, and it's erythrocyte sedimentation rate, often used as commonly referred to as a sed rate, is used as a very non-specific marker of inflammation in the body. And this is systemic inflammation. If you just, irritate something in one little spot, your sed rate will remain normal. But if there's an active degree of inflammatory response in your body, your sed rate tends to go up. The levels that you reported initially, had been trending down. And it sounds like your physician was suspecting that some of the muscular discomfort in your legs was related to your Lipitor.
Initially, yes.
But if your Lipitor is been basically off, you haven't been taking it for quite some time now, and your sed rate is going up, then there's some other issue that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, the sed rate itself is very nonspecific. It is not characteristic of one particular medical problem. It's simply a red flag that goes up that says something's going on. And basically, your physician needs to very carefully go through any additional symptoms or physical findings that you have and then look for any other laboratory studies that can help confirm where this inflammation is coming from. But at this juncture, it would be hard to implicate your Lipitor as the cause.
Yeah, and I've been told to go back on it, but for the last couple of weeks I've shied away from doing that only because of, not knowing exactly what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And nonetheless, despite staying off it a little longer than the doctor had said I could go back on it, nonetheless, I get this huge spike that
right.
comes in. And I just am concerned that, is it something life-threatening or, is there some, because my joints as well as my muscles and my body all are affected by this. Yeah, they're just not the same, and the energy loss is incredible.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if there's, without being an alarmist, I'm just wondering if there's something... What would we have to go further with? What kind of testing to see other avenues that might be worthy of exploration?
Well, in many instances, if your pain is related to the joints and muscles, a rheumatologic workup would be in order. Things like rheumatoid arthritis are very commonly associated with high sedimentation rates. Other forms of inflammatory joint disease can be associated with an elevated sed rate. Certain chronic multi-system disease processes are, again, the associated with that elevated SED rate, which is very nonspecific. There is actually a fairly wide range of possibilities associated with an elevated SED rate. It's really going to be dependent on what additional symptoms, where are they located, and what additional physical findings do you have that'll pinpoint whether this is primarily a joint or a muscle problem. But there are specific laboratory studies in terms of blood tests that can be done to help sort that out.
Yes. Yeah. So can I look forward then probably to additional blood work and any other kind of testing I can at least see on the horizon?
Blood work for sure, and then depending on what it shows, that'll lead you down, you know, another path.
Yeah. Okay. My main concern, as I said, I was wondering whether any of this might indicate life-threatening disorders as opposed to chronic pain or something like that, which is terrible, but you know, it's not going to threaten your life.
Right. At this point, it's a little early to say, but the vast majority of inflammatory processes are things that are indeed treatable and not usually life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that background. I'll let you get to some of the other people calling in. Oh. I do appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay.
We are just a little bit beyond our midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here. We take your general health care questions. The show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, 333-9455 here in Champaign, Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone calling from Paxton. They're on a cell phone here. It's line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question for the doctor, and since I'm on the cell, I'll go ahead and listen off air.
Okay.
I'm 50, and I just had a cataract removed, and actually I'm going back to Carl in 2 weeks to have my other eye cataract removed, and I can tell you that the change is quite profound. They use a non-stitch method, and it's wonderful not to have glasses for the first time in 45 years. My question for the doctor is, I asked, and I was just curious, I've heard two reasons behind cataracts. First of all, having them under the age of 50 is rare, but it's not unheard of. And I've heard it could be a genetic makeup, or if you had some sort of blunt trauma to the eye at one point, that could bring it on. And I was just wondering if the doctor had any speculation, both, neither, whatever, and exactly what is the cataract? Is it a protein deposit? You know, what is the makeup of that? And I'll go ahead and ring off and listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, as our caller mentioned, it is relatively uncommon, though not unheard of, for folks under the age of 50 to have sufficient problems with their cataracts to require surgery. Most of us think of cataracts as sort of an age-related problem, and most patients are, 20 years older than our caller. Consequently, the vast majority of cataracts are indeed just an age-related degeneration in the protein that is within the lens. The lens in our eye is a tissue. It's not a lens like in your glasses where it's just an inanimate object. It is a biological component of our eye, and the protein there can degenerate and over time become cloudy. And essentially, looking through a cataract is kind of like looking through a dirty window. And at some point in time, you say, well, gee, my vision's bad enough that I want to clean the window. And in this particular case, you simply remove the old lens and you can put a new artificial lens in there. And that often does make a dramatic improvement in people's vision. But really, the only reason to undergo the surgery is vision that you've just decided that you can't put up with anymore. The caller was correct. For folks under the age of 50, there's either a genetic component to it or, most commonly, a history of blunt trauma to the eye causing an injury to the lens. And this is, again, if problematic enough, then you simply have the lens replaced. Mm.
And you say that the average age, when it gets to the point where it's bad enough, where you say, okay, I'm not seeing well enough, you want to have surgery, is what, about 70?
I would say 70 or beyond.
Mm-hmm. Next is Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Hi.
Yeah.
I have a quick question.
My son is 7 months old. Hello?
Yeah. Hello, we got you.
Okay. And we were at the doctor, and he's got rough spots on his knees and his wrists and his elbows. And she said that he's fair-skinned and has blue eyes, so he has eczema. But I forgot to mention that my father and I both have psoriasis. Is it possible my son has psoriasis, and can you even tell at this age?
It may be very difficult to tell at this age, but there is some relationship between eczema and psoriasis in the sense that both are representative of changes in the outer layers of the skin where you start to get thickening and then scaling, and then that gets kind of irritated. Obviously, if it breaks down, can then get infected. But in certain individuals, eczema, allergies, and asthma are often seen in the family history and represent a change in the basically the immune response. And in infants, eczema is fairly common. It can be associated with allergies and asthma as they get older. And at this stage of the game, the treatment for eczema or psoriasis would still be about the same for an infant, which would be basically a good moisturizing lotion so that that thicker skin doesn't dry, crack, bleed, get infected. And then depending on the response to that, there are either cortisone-based topical treatments, or there are a few new medications that can also be used on the skin that are not cortisone-based. I'm not quite sure whether they're approved for use in someone as young as 7 months of age. Most of the studies in kids with these medications have been done in children over the age of two.
Because it was it's really scaly on the knees and the mm-hmm. elbows, and he has really bad cradle cap, and we thought it was related to that, and it wasn't, so we weren't sure what we could do. But I just want to know if it was related to our psoriasis, because we've got it pretty bad in our family. So
a little early to say yet, but certainly a distinct possibility.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, Matt Toon is next. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm 80 years old and have a torn tendon in my right arm, and I wonder what I can expect in the way of treatment.
Does it limit your activities right now?
Not too much, no. When I turn it certain ways or lift it certain ways, I get some pain in it or terrific cramping. But otherwise, I'm living pretty normally with it.
Okay. And how long has it been since the injury?
Well, at least last February, I went to my primary because I had a bulging bicep.
Uh-huh.
And he suggested exercises, which did not do anything. But just in the last 3 weeks, suddenly it's become worse and very painful at one point.
If you have separated the attachment of the bicep muscle from where it anchors by basically disrupting the tendon that connects it, your options are learn to live with it, if you can,
mm-hmm.
or surgically try and reattach it.
Mm-hmm.
In many, many instances, if the bicep is not terribly uncomfortable, many times it will be left alone.
I see.
And
is that because of my age?
No, not necessarily. Even younger folks, if it doesn't significantly impair what it is that they need to do on a daily basis, it may not be worthwhile
mm-hmm.
fixing it.
Well, I'm going to have a revision surgery in a hip. And I know that I'll be using a walker for at least 6 weeks, and I just don't know how this arm is going to accommodate that walker.
Well, if you're having hip surgery, I'm assuming that you're going to be chatting with your orthopedic surgeon in advance
yes.
of that.
And, yes.
And I think your concerns about your arm would be very well addressed by him as well, depending on the exact amount of disruption and how much residual strength you have, how much discomfort you have, he could help you decide whether this is something that is worthwhile trying to repair as well.
I see. All right. Well, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. Next, someone in Bloomington, someone calling on a cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I have a fairly large hydrocele in my left testicle, and I had one doctor say it should be removed. It's not painful at all, and I just wonder what you think about it, if it needs to be removed or if it can stay with me for a while longer or what.
The hydrocele itself is simply a benign collection of fluid between two layers of tissue in the scrotum. And as long as it's not physically uncomfortable to you, there isn't anything that you have to do about it. Basically,
it's not painful at all, and I just wondered how important if it would have to be removed, or I don't have any insurance plan right now, and that's why I'm debating if I should go into have it removed or not.
There's nothing urgent or emergent about having that type of surgery. So if it's not bothering you and you want to wait, I think that's perfectly fine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right, thanks for the call. About 10 minutes left here with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic. This is a show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and general health care questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we have a lull in the calls here. Why don't we do the flu shot thing as we are coming up to that time of the year when people maybe can get it. Certainly a lot of places are healthcare institutions and the HMOs and public health districts and so forth are making them available. What now is the recommendations about who could, should get a flu shot?
Basically, they've expanded some of the recommendations for flu shots to include more infants and children. Pregnant women at any stage of their pregnancy, the traditional folks, those over the age of 65, and those who have chronic underlying medical illnesses such as heart or lung disease or bad diabetes, are all recommended to get the flu shot.
Okay. And now this, and people who are covered by various health plans, I'm assuming that they're probably most of those plans will provide the shot. All you got to do is go in and show them your card and you can get the shot. Also, I think, though, are there places like your shop, for example, for people who walk in and want to get a shot at some charge, they can actually, assuming that they have the money in their pocket to pay for it, they can just say, here's, give me the shot and here's some money.
Yes, as long as there aren't any contraindications to getting the immunization itself.
Okay. Starting pretty soon, what's the window?
It's usually the last week of October is when things usually gear up to start giving flu shots, and then they'll be given all the way through the end of the year.
Okay, very good. All right, let's go to Champaign, line one, for somebody else right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I recently did an open water swim, a long-distance swim, in very cold water wearing a wetsuit. This is all germane because as I finished, it was about a mile and a half, I tried to stand up, got a fabulous cramp in my right calf. I was assisted up and out of the water. I thought that the cramp was going to go away. It did not for about a week. And at the end of the week, I noticed a giant bruise down at the bottom of my foot, and I was wondering if that would be more indicative of maybe a slight muscle tear or if that indeed can happen as a result of a massive leg cramp.
They're sort of part and parcel the same thing. You, in some respects, either irritated the muscle through your activity and it cramped, or you actually tore a fiber as a result of overexerting yourself, but in any instance, blood was released from the site of injury. The blood itself is irritating and stimulates more of a cramp, and then you kind of get this vicious cycle of the injury and the cramping going on, but the blood in your foot is basically blood that leaked out from above and just fell due to gravity to the lowest point. But you're correct. It does indicate some sort of tear, whether that came as a result of the cramp or whether an injury caused the cramp, sort of impossible to prove, but it could have been either.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have somebody here who's calling off the air who wanted to hear a little conversation about treatment for head lice in kids. And it's actually, this is something that I'm glad that the caller raised it, because it seems like I was talking about this with a colleague not too long ago, talking about the fact that when we were children, now these many decades ago, I don't ever remember ever hearing about this being a particular problem. And it seems that in recent years, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just hearing about it more, it seems to be more prevalent than it was 30, 40 years ago. Is it, in fact, more common?
I really don't think so. I mean, this has been around for
I know that lice have been probably
hundreds of years.
Almost as long as there have been human beings, there have been these things. Yeah.
But I do think that in any situation where you have a lot of people congregated together, it's a whole lot easier to spread it from one to another. So, if you want to go way back in a primarily rural agrarian society where your closest neighborhood was 10 miles away, there probably wasn't a whole lot of infestations. You put, 35 children in a classroom, indoors in the winter, and let them play together. Yeah, it's pretty likely it's going to get spread.
Yeah, okay.
But no, I'm at least in terms of my own personal practice, I'm not aware of any dramatic increase.
Okay. So what's the standard treatment?
Basically, the a topical pesticide is applied to the hair. Some of these are over-the-counter products. Some of them are still prescription. And basically, you try and kill the active lice, and then the traditional fine tooth comb is used literally to pick out what are called the nits, which are essentially just the eggs that are attached to the hair shafts. And this is where our term nitpicking comes from, because they really are quite tiny, and you're simply trying to physically remove them from the hair using a very fine tooth comb.
All right. Not only do you learn stuff about health here, ladies and gentlemen, etymology, you also get some of that too. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Not too long ago, a few weeks ago, there was a big wave of concern about spinach, fresh spinach that was contaminated with E. coli, and a lot of people got sick. And I think actually there was at least one.
At least two.
A couple of people actually died.
Yes.
I was thinking about that again, just because I think I saw an item in the paper just today that apparently there's also some concern in the state of California about lettuce and the same issue. So I guess I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about foodborne illness, and about what to do if you suspect that you've gotten sick because of something that you ate, and particularly, I guess, at what point you think that you might need some medical attention, or is it in most cases just something like, you're going to feel terrible and you may be having diarrhea and that and so forth, but other than making sure you keep hydrated, there's not very much you can do.
The more common food poisonings are generally self-limited. Your body pretty quickly recognizes that there's something not right about what you ate, and you either have vomiting or diarrhea.
Body says, get this stuff out of here.
Yeah. And basically, vomiting and diarrhea are essentially the same thing, just kind of at different ends of the intestinal tract. You're trying to basically purge yourself of whatever it is that's disagreeing with you. And generally speaking, within 24 to 48 hours, you should be feeling better. Now, with some of the toxic strains of E. coli, that's a different story, and that's a much more significant illness, and your symptoms are not going to be self-limited. And in fact, there is a whole subsequent type of illness called hemolytic uremic syndrome, where this is what people actually die of when their kidneys shut down. But basically, if things aren't, you know, very quickly better after eating something that's been contaminated, you should indeed seek medical attention because, as you pointed out, all of that is going to get worse if you get dehydrated. If you're having continuous vomiting or diarrhea, you're losing fluids, and if you can't replace that and become significantly dehydrated, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage in terms of being able to fight the infection. Now, there are other kinds of bacteria that can cause, and parasites and all sorts of viruses that can cause, quote, food poisoning. But in this particular case, you need a specific study to check and see exactly what it is that's causing your illness. So if it really hasn't resolved in 24 to 48 hours, you should get checked out.
Yeah. Other than if you're going to be eating some vegetable item or fruit, something like that, you know, other than making sure that you wash it really well, if this is something that you're going to have raw,
right?
Is there anything else that you can really do, or is that pretty much the...
Well, the other part is meat.
Oh, well, yeah.
That has to be very thoroughly cooked in order to destroy some of the bacteria that can indeed be present in raw meat, both beef and poultry.
Yeah, and obviously you got to be really careful how you handle raw meat. You want to make sure you don't do cross-contamination. You want to keep your cutting boards. So if you use it for that, only use it for that. Make sure you wash your hands real well, right. All that, you know, all that kind of stuff. Don't use the same utensils. Make sure you keep all that kind of stuff separate.
That's correct.
Okay. Let us go to Urbana line one. Hello.
Yes. A question for the doctor. I enjoy the show. I'm suffering from mid-severe clinical depression. Been on high dose antidepressants for quite a while, and I'm wondering what your philosophy was on ECT. I've been working closely with my doctors, and we have talked about this. I'm leaning toward that because I'm not getting much better. I was wondering what your philosophy was on ECT.
I think ECT was used fairly commonly a number of years ago. It sort of fell by the wayside as some of the newer antidepressant medications came on board. But I think of late there's been a little bit more consideration of use of ECT again. Primarily in individuals who have not responded well to the antidepressant medications. And if in fact you've used a number of different medications or combinations of medications and still are experiencing significant depression, then ECT is indeed on the list of things to consider. There isn't any sort of right or wrong answer here. It's simply a question of, have you gone through all of the other alternatives that you're, you know, willing to try, and has your physician, you know, looked actively at all of the medical and psychological issues in your particular case. But certainly, I think of late, ECT has made a bit of a comeback in the really stubborn, resistant depressions. So it's not an unreasonable thing to consider.
Okay, I guess one concern I have is, I mean, I know it's controversy, and there's talk of, you know, memory loss. That would, I guess, be one of my concerns.
It is a known possibility, yes.
Is that overcome in time?
The response to this is so highly individual, there really isn't any way to predict that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks
okay.
for the call. We're just about at the point where we're going to have to wrap up here. Just under the general headline of nagging people, to do things, simple things that maybe will keep them healthier, particularly now that we're moving into the season for flus and colds. I just came across this recent item here that according to the Soap and Detergent Association, and there is one, which commissioned a survey, U.S. adults get a C- for their hand cleaning habits. And apparently they find that, most people don't wash their hands all that much. Between 3% of the people say they only wash their hands between 1 and 2 times a day. 11% 3 to 4 times, and it goes up from there. And when they wash, do you typically lather them or rub them with soap, and for how long, all that kind of stuff? 69% of participants in the survey didn't claim to wash their hands for more than 20 seconds. So if you want to try and stay healthy this winter, the bottom line here is one of the biggest and easiest things you can do is frequent hand washing.
That's true. And it's still emphasized in the hospital setting where, you know, there are all sorts of antiseptics and antibiotics, but it's still noted that the leading cause of, you know, basically the spread of infectious illness within the hospital is basically patients, staff members, visitors not washing their hands adequately.
I know that you're wearing a necktie. I did come across also an item in some sort of British medical journal that they're after their doctors to stop wearing ties.
Why is
because
that?
They think that they can harbor germs. Because you don't wash your ties, do you? Have you ever had your neckties cleaned?
They are dry cleaned.
Oh, okay. Oh, good for you. Very good. Well, I guess we'll leave it at that. Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he does have his ties dry cleaned. He's with us every other month. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic in Urbana. Thank you very much for being here.
I'll look forward to being back again.
Okay.
Thank you.